Welcome to the CodeCast Podcast. Real-world insights for your daily medical coding and billing processes. And now, here's your host, Terry Fletcher.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the CodeCast Podcast this week. My name is Terry Fletcher. We are in episode 88, which means today we are going to talk about something that I've been bringing up for a long time, but haven't had a chance to actually put it in words for you. And I really wanted to make sure that you had all of the authoritative references. It's not just saying, well, Terry says we should do this, so this is what we should do. Even though you know how much I do like it when you guys say that. But we want to make sure that when you bring it back to your physician's practices or you're talking to your providers about it, that you just have some information that they're saying, where are you getting this? And then you know where you can get it. So a couple of things I'm going to bring to your attention today. And this comes from auditing over 800 records in the month of June, so I'm actually going blind with my auditing right now. But I do love auditing because it just lets me see still what's out there that a lot of practices aren't understanding. And the biggest error I saw was the lack of supporting documentation and the lack still of understanding of what it is needed to use time as the controlling factor of your visit codes. Also, I have probably had 4 to 5 emails in the past couple of months saying that several practices are being dropped from their largest payer as a preferred provider, and their patients are going elsewhere, and they're not sure why. Well, I can tell you what it is. It's patient satisfaction surveys. I've kind of touched on that a little bit. I know in February I talked about it just a little bit. And last year, I think episode 89 in July, I did a social media and healthcare podcast. But this is different. This is basically about your money and your contracts. And it's not only gotten more prominent that patients are in control of your contracts, but if you are trying to get re-signed each year from your payer to make sure that you keep your existing patients, that's something you're going to have to incorporate. It's not something you are saying, well, we don't do it. And I know a lot of you aren't, but you're going to have to at least consider bringing that in as part of your practice. But first, the CodeCast Podcast is brought to you by Gaffey Healthcare. Better technology, better results, GaffeyHealth.com. And WA, SoCal, Women in Healthcare of Southern California, a nonprofit professional association for women healthcare leaders, WHASOCAL.org. Okay, so first of all, let's talk about that time element. That's something that is really important because I think a lot of providers, whether it be physicians or mid-level providers, or anyone who is trying to bill for a certain level of service, they tend to, I don't want to say get lazy or sloppy with their documentation effort, but they'll say, well, you know what I'm going to do? I'm just going to base it on I spent 25 minutes with the patient. And so since, let's say, a 99214 office visit established patient actually says that, it says that it is a typical time of 25 minutes, then the provider feels that that's all I have to do and I've supported my level 4 service. Well, that is inaccurate. So here it is from not just an AMA CPT book perspective, so the documentation guidelines, but I'm telling you as an auditor, this is what I look for. And if I don't see it, I won't consider it as part of support for your visit code. So CPT, professional edition, page 10, right column, number 3 entry says, and I'll quote it, when counseling and or coordination of care dominates more than 50% of the encounter with the patient and or the family face-to-face time in the office or other outpatient setting or floor unit time in the hospital or nursing facility, then time shall be considered the key or controlling factor. Factor to qualify for a particular level of E&M service. And then it goes on to say the extent of counseling and or coordination of care must be documented in the medical record. The part of that that is not always taken into, I should say, consideration is the extent of counseling and what's documented. I get the time. I get that nice little click and paste salutation that says 50% or more was spent counseling. Then I get the total time of the visit. I even get how much time was spent counseling the patient. What I don't get is what was part of the counseling. So when counseling and or coordination of care dominates that 50% of the time of that physician visit, and then they want to use that as their controlling factor to qualify for a particular level of service, then the physician must follow 3 things. And this is what you want to bring back to your practices just to make sure. And this is on almost every audit tool anyway. So number 1, total length of time. It's better if it's start and stop times, but if it's total length of the visit and of the E&M visit. And then because of that, then you want to say evidence that more than half of the total length of time of the E&M visit was spent in counseling or coordination of care. A lot of medical records and EHRs, EMRs have basically a click and paste or a drop-down screen that will automatically auto-populate the field saying 50% or more was spent counseling. Okay, so you've met two out of three. But here's number three, the content of the counseling and coordination of care provided during the E&M visit must be well documented in the medical record. What I get is I'll get a record that probably will, I'd say support maybe a level three office visit, 99213, which has a typical time of 15 minutes. And then I'll get a physician saying that 40 minutes was spent to the visit, 50% or more counseling, and that's it. And I don't see anything else. I see return to clinic, you know, 4 months. I'll see, I'll go back up to the history of present illness, and it does list, you know, the things that they were seen for, the HPI elements, a little bit of expansion on that, but not in counseling form. It's just part of the HPI. I'll go back to the exams to make sure that that was linked to the history. That's all linked. Okay. Then I go to the assessment and plan or the medical decision making, and I'll see things that there's a diagnosis, then underneath what we're going to do with that diagnosis. But it's rare actually now that I'll actually see spent time counseling with the patient, see time threshold below, and then what that conversation was. Patient was concerned if they go into surgery that that'll have counteraction with this and this medicine or with this, you know, underlying condition they have. Something that reflects that the doctor basically had to stop the exam and look at the patient and have a conversation. It's not the overall exam or it's the overall visit encounter, because there is a narrative to that, that there is talking to the patient and going over things with the patient. This is a specific reason to counsel them and make decisions on something that is, I don't want to say outside the box, but it's more about the what you're going to talk to them about. And when we talk about counseling, are they going to do it? Aren't they going to do it? So you're trying to help them make informed decisions and choices with the information you're giving them. Coordination of care. Okay, well, before you see before you have your surgery or your procedure, we need you to see your cardiologist because you need to stop Coumadin. We also need you to be cleared by your pulmonologist because we know you're being followed for your lung nodule. We also want to talk to you right now about making sure that you're looking and having a conversation with possibly a dietitian, because if we're going to do a total joint on you, I'm concerned with the weight you're at right now, that that's going to be a problem. And so if that content is in there and that documentation is in there and that detail in the context of that conversations and any decisions made or actions based on that counseling is well documented, then yes, you can use time as the controlling factor when you're trying to say this is the total office visit. There's also an article that you can look up on your own, and it's in the CPT Assistant, and it is Volume 10, Issue 12, December 2000. And again, CPT Assistant, Volume 10, Issue 12, December 2000. And it's called Evaluation and Management Time. And that article has extensive information regarding the elements required when billing based on time. And it will just help you give information to your physicians. And the last thing I really want to talk about on this, and this is an audit tip if you're ever flagged for it. Remember that if you have a physician that documents 45 minutes spent with the patient, of which 50% or more was spent counseling on every single visit. And let's say in one day of patient offices, the physician saw 20 patients from 9 a.m. to 1 p.m. Do the math. Does that make sense to any auditor that they actually spent that kind of time? Or is it even possible in a 4-hour period that you can see, you know, that many patients? So that's 15 hours of documented patient time in a 4-hour period for 20 patients. So that's a complete audit flag, and we want to make sure that you're not getting in trouble for using time but not being mindful of what that really is. I get doctors all the time with critical care getting into trouble because they give their critical time, total time. I don't get a paragraph of what was critical. I just get a diagnosis, and they say to me, well, you should know because of the diagnosis. Well, I do know because that is an acute diagnosis, but I don't have any idea what you did during that time. You need to have some kind of life-saving methods with that patient. The other thing is I'll get physicians that'll say, I spent 4 hours of critical care time with this patient. I spent another three with this patient, and I'll check to see how long the physician was at the hospital, and they were there an hour. Again, do the math. And everybody now, especially some specific RAC auditors, they're looking at schedules. And so it's just important that you bring this information to your physicians, or it could get to be a problem. So before I start talking about my patient satisfaction surveys and what that means for your contracting world, I want to give you your coding question. And today is from my client in Denver, Colorado. And it says, Terry, we just purchased your gastroenterology coding resource online and we love it. Thank you very much. But we have a question we didn't find in your book. You mentioned that we cannot code for a pre-screening visit with a CPT E&M code, but CPT codes S0285 is a consult prior to a screening colonoscopy, and we are, for the most part, getting paid, even though we are getting denials from Medicare. Can you tell us if we are even supposed to be billing this? Okay, so in answer to your question, the S0285 code, first of all, that's not a CPT code. You need to know your books. This is a HCPCS code, an HCPCS code. So HCPCS means Healthcare Common Procedural Coding System. This is a separate book. It's made up of alphanumeric codes that include injectable drugs, orthopedic supports, IV solutions, things like that, kind of tangible items. It is also a separate code book that Medicare and HIAA, Health Insurance Association of America, they add and subtract from several times a year. So they adjust medicine vial doses, certain units on other drugs, but they also add these informational codes like the S codes that may be used for reporting, but may not always be reimbursed. So that's why I call them informational. So S0285 does exist. It does say it's a consult or an office visit prior to a screening colonoscopy. It does not have a dollar value for Medicare, and it doesn't have a dollar value for Medicaid or for Medicare Advantage plans. It actually has a invalid status 1 availability, so it's not considered for payment with any government plan. And most of my workbooks follow Medicare rules. But after July 1st, 2017, I did notice that some commercial plans we're starting to pick it up and pay for it about $60. Not every plan will do it, but Moda Health, Blue Cross Blue Shield of North Carolina, United Healthcare of Texas, they were considering this code for that pre-screening service. But this is, Medicare doesn't feel that a pre-screening visit is a billable service because there's no chief complaint. So there's no support for an E&M, which is a problem-oriented visit. I would agree with that. Remember, an E&M service, an evaluation and management service, starts with a chief complaint unless you're using a preventative service, and that means you're doing head-to-toe. Typical pre-screening visits are for just that specific cause, and they're just really a Q&A, more of a history visit. I like to call them a meet and greet. And if you want to charge a cash fee for a meet and greet, let's say that you have a pre-screening colonoscopy, pre-screening mammogram, a pre-screening aneurysm, even if you are a pediatric practice and you have parents that want to meet the physician before they start treating or become a physician of record for their child, then those are meet and greets. And you go back to the unlisted code of 99499, it doesn't get billed to an insurance payer and the patient is responsible for it. So Medicare is pretty specific, and they came out with a Q&A, an LCD, and a NCD that you cannot bill for a pre-screening visit. But they're saying that you should set them up for open access, meaning that if they're going to call in for a screening colonoscopy or screening anything, you send them over for their screening. And when you do that, you are basically, I guess, trusting that the physician that recommended they have a screening did the history and exam prior to them being sent for the procedure alone. I know that takes a lot of trust, and that's hard to do for the procedural physicians, but it is a Medicare rule. And so hopefully that answered the question. That's why I didn't include it in my workbook, because I didn't want you to think you could bill it for any Medicare, Medicare Advantage, or Medicaid patient. If you find that particular commercial plan that pays it, great. But remember also one thing, you said in your question that for the most part we're getting paid. Well, what about the parts you aren't getting paid for? So let's say that Moda Health and United Healthcare are paying for it, but Blue Cross Blue Shield of California, of Texas, of Michigan are not. Those are three that I know that aren't paying for it anyway. Then what do? Well, you can't write it off. Remember, when you submit a claim to an insurance company and you expect payment, that means that you have to charge the patient. Now, because Medicare says that you can't charge a pre-screening visit, that's why you're getting your denials, Medicare would actually come back and get you for choosing a patient on that, only because the reason they say you can't is that it's invalid status one, almost like a B status, meaning that a portion of that evaluation and management effort is included in any screening visit. And so if you're interested in taking a gastroenterology webinar, I talk about this at length all the time. Please go to my website at terryfletcher.net and, you know, pick up one of the on-demand webinars on this, because we really talk about pre-screening when it comes to this. So this is just a question that comes up quite a bit. Today's coding question was brought to you by ICD-10monitor.com, helping healthcare providers make informed decisions as they continue to implement and perfect the ICD-10 and soon-to-be ICD-11 coding system, ICD-10monitor.com. And the live broadcast, it's called Talk 10 Tuesdays. Those are every Tuesday morning live at 7 a.m. Pacific Time and 10 a.m. Eastern Time. I'm on about twice a month as an editorial advisory member. And July 2nd, which is today, I was actually also on in the morning this morning at 7. And you'll find my latest article on cloned notes on ICD-10monitor.com under news. Today's episode is also brought to you by True Crime Fix Podcast. Follow them on Facebook at True Crime Fix Podcast for every Friday night download. You can also find them on iTunes and Spotify. I don't mean to laugh, and I told them I'm really trying to hold back, but I know what you're thinking. They're a sponsor of my show. Why? And I have no idea, but they said, hey, we want to buy, you know, 5 episodes of sponsoring your show. And I said, okay, it's a free market. But maybe they think that us healthcare professionals have a dark side, and maybe we do. So I bet a few of you will go look it up and see what it's all about. So True Crime Fix Podcast. I just think it's funny. It's actually kind of cool to me that they would want to do that. So I want to shout out to my loyal listeners for the week, and that would be Anna in Texas. And thank you, Anna, for endorsing me on LinkedIn for coding. I appreciate that. Guayatari, I hope I pronounced that right, in Wilmington. I loved your comment on LinkedIn. You said that I was your virtual mentor. That was so sweet. Thank you. Marina in Kentucky and Cindy Lou in Texas. So I love the feedback. Keep it coming. It just makes me happy to know that everybody's listening and enjoying the podcast. Also, I just wanted to remind you, if you could take a minute and rate and review us on iTunes or your listening platforms, we would really appreciate it. If you listen on YouTube, you know, give the big thumbs up for us. It gets noticed. And we were nominated again this year for the podcast Best of the Best Awards in business category and in the healthcare category. So I was pretty excited about that. So now let me talk to you about patient satisfaction surveys. So the reason that this is such an issue, and one thing that actually is funny to me, sometimes, and I've talked about it before, about making lists and making sure that you can cross things off, it'll keep you kind of stress-free. It was pointed out to me by my content and music producer that I continue to make lists that have numbers attached to them. So top 10 Tuesdays at the end of the month, I said, oh, the top 9 this, the top thing that, you know, I give you numbers. Okay, here we go again, the top 8 ways to improve patient satisfaction scores. So I know some of you hopefully really like that, because you'd be like, oh, I have 8 ways, and you write it down, or you're just like, here she goes again. So I'm not sure you appreciate it, but I didn't realize I was doing that until somebody pointed it out to me. So I just kind of thought it was funny. But physician reimbursement is being increasingly impacted with those patient satisfaction scores. So once this was really only something hospitals had to worry about, but now it's affecting practices of all sizes. And getting those good scores, it's becoming harder and harder. The reason is, and this is what I believe, patients are comparing their healthcare experience against the experiences they have in retail and the service sector. And let's face it, healthcare hasn't been known for providing modern, super engaging, seamless experiences. Still, one study was showing that about half of patients expect the same customer service experience in healthcare that they get in a retail store. So I guess you need to be Nordstrom and not Kmart. This trend shows it's more important than ever to be able to track and monitor patient satisfaction and take steps to improve it. You're going to need it, because there's some changing expectation of patients, and you want to effectively gauge what patients think and identify areas for improvement. And I'm just going to give you some best practices to follow. So hopefully this will help you. And when you do a survey, there's a couple of different things you should know. There's a company called CAHPS, C-A-H-P-S, and that stands for the Consumer Assessment of Healthcare Providers and Systems, and it's a Survey Monkey. So again, C-A-H-P-S, and I may put this on my blog as well. I just put up a blog yesterday on the ways to email that from my podcast last week, but I'll put a blog up for this so you can read about it. But you can't do anything about preset CAHPS surveys, but it's if you don't have one already, that's the one that you want to go to. But you can control the length and complexity of a patient survey that you send out. So it shouldn't take more than 5 minutes to complete, and it really should focus on a single topic. So like their recent visit or changes you've made, like new technology or services for them. I wouldn't try to ask everything about every service, and I also wouldn't duplicate my efforts. So number two would be timely. For a post-visit patient survey, send it out within 24 to 48 hours. The sooner the better. You want to strike while the patients remember their experience. Well, some of you don't want to do that. I was mentioning a couple weeks ago how I was dealing with a shoulder issue. Turns out I have a frozen shoulder. That's what I thought it was. Well, I found out that it was actually misdiagnosed, and now I realize now that I've got a bone spur and I might have to have surgery. But the problem is that I absolutely have a problem with this practice's staff. The doctor I like, the PA I like, the staff I'm not happy with. And it's because they're just so cold and inapproachable, and I should say unapproachable, and just very, you can tell that they're just not either happy with their job or they don't understand what their job is. And so I'm if they have me fill out a survey, it's not going to be pretty. But get hard data. So avoid creating open-ended survey questions. It's appropriate to have a spot at the end of your survey for additional comments, but you want to be able to easily analyze the data. So use multiple choice and yes or no questions. So for example, you don't want to say, tell us what you thought of the wait time. No. You want to say, was the wait time reasonable? Yes or no. Just give them one way to go or the other. Otherwise, you're going to get a book on something that it's going to be hard to analyze. And then go digital. Create and send your surveys electronically. People prefer online survey 30 times more than the paper ones, unless you have older patients and you want to attach it to their fee ticket or whatever you give them as a receipt as they leave the office. A lot of patients have something about their next visit. But using a digital platform also allows you to automate the sending of surveys, personalize them to the patient, and you can also see the results a lot quicker. Problem areas. So there are a few key areas where patients focus on when it comes to satisfaction. Now, when you hear these areas, you're going to hear one area that isn't in there. So the number one is poor experience with office staff, like I just mentioned. Number two is feeling more like a number than a person. Yep, I feel that way as well. Difficulty scheduling, both wait times and availability of methods for scheduling. And then poor communication with the office. Did you hear anything in there about treatment? No, nothing about the doctor, nothing about how the healthcare that you received on its own was. It was just about the office staff and the communication and how you were made to feel. And so those are definitely some things that you want to know if that's happening. Take the opportunity to ask if staff were friendly, patients found it easy to schedule an appointment, or if patient received communication from the practice through their preferred method, either text or email, and patients get to choose that now. And then make those changes. Take this simple feedback and make a list of areas to work on, and then you can begin to tackle improvements. So you might want to group potential improvements, so into small changes and big changes. A small change might be something like temperature control, and a big change might be something like service training with the staff. That's something I started doing. I swear, sometimes I'm like, I'm a coder, an auditor, an educator, and you name it, I do it now. So I'm training front office staff, back office staff, physicians, designing waiting rooms, you name it, I'm doing it. So it's kind of interesting sometimes of how things evolve. Tackle bigger changes one at a time. So the little things like adding a coffee station or a drink station to the waiting room can quickly be ticked off the list. And if you add anything like that, that is a coffee station or a drink station, make sure you know if you're changing it out. You don't want this morning's coffee there at 3:00 in the afternoon. And a lot of older people drink coffee all day long. Also, if you're using real creamer, so half and half or something that's a milk product, make sure you've got a refrigerator versus the non-dairy that can sit out as long as it needs to. Also, if you're, and you want a trash can there, you want stir sticks. I had a practice that did that and I'm like, do you have any stir sticks or spoons? She's like, oh no, we don't. I'm like, okay. And this is what she said to me. because I got a cup of coffee. And she said, she goes, oh, it usually just mixes itself if you just swish it around. I'm telling you, okay, we're just going to move on from that because I'm sure you can look at my face right now and I'm just wasn't happy. So get as much buy-in on the big changes as possible. But share the feedback from patients and ask for input on how to improve. And then get your staff involved and engage. Be open to changes and or upgrades in technology and processes to help address those problems or situations. And then follow up, and this is the last one. Make sure that you implement changes and settle into new ways of doing things that you follow up to see what patients think. Surveys shouldn't be static. So if you've made changes, then change your post-survey visit or send out a single survey specifically about those changes. Did they like the change? Following up shows patients you are committed to improving their experience and continues to engage them in the process. And if you have these types of ongoing interactions and engagement, that's the way to build your loyalty. And when they get a survey now from a payer, you're going to get re-signed. And that's the bottom line. You want to make sure that you are getting re-signed, that you have a payer that understands that you want to continue to be a preferred provider and not be kind of stuck there. So that's really, really important. Okay, so my end tidbit, and this week, I don't know if I wanted to tell you this, but I started watching this new show on Netflix, and it took me a while to even figure out how Netflix worked, but my daughter has it, so I signed into her account, and now I'm kind of hooked with my eyes closed on this one show, and it's called Black Mirror. I don't know if anybody's seen it, but some of you are gonna be like, oh, I know that show. It's in a friend of mine, he's the one that started getting me watching it, but it's like Twilight Zone for the 21st century. I'm telling you people, it's creepy. So I recommend you watch it with someone you can grab onto next to you with the lights on, but it's so thought-provoking and it stays with you for days. And I used to love this when I was younger, but in a show, I'm like, why am I watching this? I mean, I was definitely a Twilight Zone junkie girl when I was younger, but this is just, it's really weird. But it's kind of like, why can't we look away from train wrecks? Well, this is it. So, and I actually found a site. It popped up on my computer, which I thought was hilarious because as soon as you start watching something, it's amazing how many of these sites have cookies and they track you. It's almost like somebody sitting on your shoulder watching what you're doing. But I had a site that popped up and said, hey, you can write an episode for it and submit it. So in my spare time, you're going to laugh at this, I actually wrote up an episode and we'll see what happens. I submitted it. So I feel like I need an agent, but they probably won't use it. But I just thought, you know what? I can get creepy. Let's just see if that actually works. So those things that are dark and deep seated in your mind, this is something that you could do. And if you end up getting a chance to watch it, please let me know what you thought of it. So I'd be interested to see everybody out there that actually listens or reads or drinks a bottle of wine that I recommend, just anything with my personal tidbits. I love to hear about it. So until next time, make it a great day, and thank you for listening to the CodeCast podcast.
For more information on medical coding, billing, auditing, and compliance, including how to hire Terry, follow Terry on Twitter at TerryCoder1 or visit her website at www.terryfletcher.net. Podcast producer Joe Kuzma. Music producer DeSassin Music.